BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Tom Sutcliffe, and this is Start the Week from BBC Radio 4. Hope you enjoy the programme. I have been thinking more than usual about cybercrime and security this week, not just because that's the subject of today's programme, because last week it was revealed that the BBC, along with other big organisations such as Boots and British Airways, had been caught up in a mass hack, a ransomware attack, with the risk that personal data had been compromised, which meant that I, along with most of the employees here, started receiving warning emails, complete with helpful links to click if we were anxious. I would have been much more reassured if I hadn't just been reading Scott Shapiro's book, Fancy Bear Goes Fishing, A History of the Dark Side of the Information Age, and Jenny Radcliffe's People Hacker, an account of her career as a social engineer, both of which underline the fact that you really need to think twice before you click links in unexpected emails, however plausible and authoritative they look. Joining them to talk about security online and in the real world today is Alice Hutchings, director of the Cambridge Cybercrime Centre and an expert in the evolution of keyboard crime and its social ecology too. Can I start by asking you all, I am in a sort of slightly heightened sense of awareness and alertness about this, but more generally, do we get our notion of the risks right? Have we got a sense of perspective about this? Scott Shapiro.
First of all, thank you for having me here today. I would say it really depends on who you are. So there are certain high-value targets, like journalists, human rights activists, people who control money. I think the risks are very high for them. They really are people out to get your information, and you should really be very careful, maybe even get professional help in securing your devices. But I think for most people, they're low value targets, and cyber criminals just want to make money. And what we need to do is make sure that it's much harder for them to get it.
Alice Hutchings, aggregate enough low-value targets and they become a high-value target. So what's your view on this?
Certainly. So the majority of cybercrime that's out there is very high volume but low value. This means that it escapes, you know, the attention of many platforms and policing agencies, and not much is done about it. So the average risk for a consumer is very small. For the overall view, it could be quite considerable for the victim, but relatively small value crimes that are just done at huge volumes, so a lot of people can be affected. But what gets into the news is the very high profile attacks, but this can be kind of misrepresentative about what's actually happening out there.
Are you suggesting that some of these attacks are so below the radar that they may have occurred without us noticing them?
Certainly, many a lot of the time that will be the case, or it might just be that you get a notification from your bank saying that they've detected a suspicious transaction. These days, often they won't actually replace cards; they'll just detect those that they can see as fitting a profile as being fraudulent.
Jenny Radcliffe, you advise on this, and you kind of give lectures on this, so you have a sort of vested interest in saying to people you should worry, but how much?
Well, thanks for having me, Tom. I mean, I think it's very dangerous to kind of play it down too much for people. We don't want to frighten people. But it's the smaller hacks and breaches that really ruins lives. So what we need people to be is vigilant. Everyone is worth hacking because everyone has an identity, is connected to other people, is in charge of whatever their own small financial world is. And so I think it's true. What the other guests have said, of course the high profile ones are the ones that make the news, but I think it's important that people are aware and educated of basic things they can do to keep themselves safer, as Scott said, because otherwise there's a danger of thinking, I'm not rich enough, famous enough or important enough to be hacked. And then that's when these hacks can get in and make victims of people.
Scott Shapiro, to come back to you, you've written this book called Fancy Bear Goes Fishing. We're going to loop back to the moment of original sin in all of this, but just before we do, can you just briefly explain who Fancy Bear is and what he was trying to catch?
Right, so Fancy Bear is a they. It's the code word given by the cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike to the one of the elite hacking units in Russian military intelligence. There's another unit called Cozy Bear. And they went fishing. That is, they sent deceptive emails to the Democratic National Committee in 2016 and were able to exfiltrate.
This was a very famous hack because it had, many people have argued, huge real-world consequences. The election of Donald Trump,
yes,
and not Hillary Clinton.
Yes, absolutely. Whether it did or didn't is much debated. It certainly didn't help, and it certainly created an element, an atmosphere of chaos around politics, which I think did help the populist challenger, Donald Trump.
One thing that I want to ask you about before we go into the history a little bit is a distinction you make, and it occurs throughout your book, and it's relevant actually to the discussion we're going to have at all levels, the distinction between upcode and downcode. What do you mean by those terms, and what's the difference between them?
Yeah, sure. So downcode is all the code below your fingertips when you're on a keyboard, so like your application, your operating system, things like that.
So software, the what we normally think of
as
code.
Exactly, the ones and zeros that you see on the in the matrix, you know, falling behind the hacker. But the upcode is all the kinds of rules and norms that govern human behavior. So my personal ethics and my beliefs, but also legal norms, social norms, the rules of the BBC, all the kinds of rules that give human beings incentives to do what they do.
And part of your point is that these are massively out of sync. We've had about 60 years of development of the internet and computers. So, and for downcode, 6 decades is 1,000 years. For upcode, it's the blink of an eye. We haven't caught up yet.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's natural to think about cybersecurity in downcode terms, that it's an engineering problem. Because obviously hacking is a very technical activity. Unless you're trained or have it explained to you, you don't know what's going on. So you think, oh, okay, well, engineers should solve it. But I think that's a mistake. And it's a mistake, I think, because downcode is written by human beings. And human beings respond to incentives like money or fame or because they find it fun. And what turns out is that the technical vulnerabilities in the downcode can always be traced to kind of human vulnerabilities or political vulnerabilities in the upcode. And what we should be doing is focusing on the rules that govern our behavior rather than shoving this question off for engineers to solve.
Let's go back right to the very beginning. The first hack that you write about is called the Great Worm, and it happens in 1988, I think.
Yes, exactly.
Who was Robert Morris, and what did he do to become the first of your extraordinary hacks?
Yeah, so I really feel for Robert Morris Jr. So Robert Morris Jr. was, he's still alive. He's a tenured professor now at MIT, but at the time he was a first-year graduate student in computer science at Cornell University, and he was interested in a science experiment. That is, how big is the internet? How many computers could a self-replicating program get on? So he one night, November 2nd, 1988, he released it, and then he went to dinner, came back, and he realized that he had just crashed the internet. It was the first time that had ever happened. And then he had I get a feeling in the pit of my stomach every time I say this, but he had to tell his dad that he had done it. And his dad was the head of cybersecurity for the National Security Agency of the United States.
Now, when we're talking about this time, you say he crashed the internet. The internet was much, much, much smaller.
Yes.
And in really the domain of specialists.
Yes.
No ordinary citizen would have known about it.
No, absolutely. In fact, the word internet had not appeared in media until that day. And actually, journalists didn't know how to call it. They didn't know it was the internet, with the I and the N capitalized. So it was a really formative moment for everyone.
Why? He didn't do it for any malicious motive. He didn't want to crash the internet. He didn't want to make money. Why did he do it?
It was really like a science experiment. I mean, so much of what hackers do, they do because they're curious, because they find it fun. It is fun. Please don't commit crimes. But it really is a fun activity. I teach my students how to hack at Yale Law School. They really enjoy it. But again, please don't commit crimes.
Some of this is the weird appeal of the no trespassing sign, isn't it? I mean, you know something about this, Jen, because you started very, very young, intrigued by no trespassing signs and wanting to get past them.
Absolutely. I mean, it's curiosity, you know, as much as anything else. And I kind of often say, you know, you shouldn't underestimate, you know, kids with nothing to do, right? And it feeds into what Alice talks about as well. And as Scott says, this is an interesting thing. This is something that could still, because it's still such a young thing, such a young technologies in some ways, is that it's people want to see how far they can take it. But, you know, I just want to just tap into something that Scott said there about hackers and hackers being fun. It's quite important that we distinguish between malicious hackers and hackers who do this for curiosity or for academic interest or anything else. The common term, and when we talk about rules and memes and things that we live by, is that hacker equals bad. That's not true. People who do crimes are criminals. There are hackers who do things because they're curious or because it's for some sort of research or something else, or to protect people from the ones that do it maliciously.
Alice Hutchings, you've researched this a lot. I mean, it does start with a kind of sort of, I'm going to use the N-word, nerdy curiosity, doesn't it?
I'd just like to really appreciate, I'm glad you said that, because I, in fact, don't like using the term hacker to describe offenders. I think that there are very different populations at play.
We should
here.
Just use a different word.
I tend to use offender, but there is a lot of kind of history around the term hacker and how this is used, and sometimes it can be rather conflated, which creates a lot of misperceptions. But certainly in terms of offender pathways, we do see that for the kind of the technical types of crimes, curiosity does seem to be a huge motivating factor. I think there are other benefits that do come along later, mainly the financial benefits that can kind of take over from those curiosity, skill development side of things. But the initial kind of looking for information about how to extend, you know, what is possible with technology often drives that curiosity.
It's interesting, isn't it, Scott, how quickly the hackers, and we'll still call them hackers at this point because we're in that sort of early innocent days, how quickly they realise that the way in is upcode. So there's a virus that a lot of people perhaps will remember was the I Love You virus, where enormous numbers of people across the world got an email saying, I love you, you know, if you want to see my love letter, click on this link. That was a classic piece of upcode hacking.
Yes, exactly, because who doesn't want to learn about their secret admirer? Everyone wants to be loved. And so I do remember getting that email, and I remember thinking, I'm happily married, so I'm not going to click on this.
You get the words for sort of perfect upcode, don't
right.
you?
Yeah, right. Exactly. I want to just also echo that not making light of criminal offending for hacking. I did want to make the point that Alice had brought up, that so much of this activity is generated initially by curiosity.
Can you tell us about the Mirai botnet? Because that's another of your extraordinary hacks. And it was a wake-up call, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was a victim, so to speak, of the Mirai botnet on October 21st, 2016.
You better explain what a botnet is.
Yes, yes, certainly. So a botnet is a connected series of infected digital devices. In the case of the Mirai botnet, it was roughly 300,000 Internet of Things devices like security cameras and DVRs, maybe some toasters. And what happened was these three teenagers had put together this gigantic botnet. Originally, it was put together so that one of the boys didn't have to take his calculus exam, and he used it to knock off the Rutgers University system offline, so he didn't have to take his exam. But
he just wanted more time to revise.
Yeah, or maybe just didn't want to take it. And so everyone had assumed, because this was 2.5 weeks before the 2016 election, that this was the Russian state hacker's fancy bearer or cozy bearer, but it turned out to have been this software that these three boys had created, which was really quite remarkable, because I couldn't use the internet for the entire day, and I don't remember that ever happening before.
One of the very unnerving lines in your book was this: in the UK, more than half of property crime is online. Now, I assume that's true generally, is it? That when we think of theft, we think of people kind of breaking in through a back window in our house, but we should be thinking online.
Yeah, so, you know, like you break into the bank because famously that's where the money is. And so now the money is not maybe in the bank, but on your laptop or something like that. And so that is, in fact, where crime is moving. Crime is becoming cybercrime. The reason why I use the UK figures is because that's what was there, but I would not be surprised if in the United States that's true as well.
Alice, when curiosity turns to crime and turns to the application of this knowledge to gain, are we still seeing the same people involved? Is it still teenage boys, which is the classic, you know, sort of ordinary layman's view of these people? Or has it moved on from that?
So it does depend on the type of crime that you're looking at. So I keep data on who's being prosecuted in the UK, and a lot of the cases that are coming through the courts are actually police officers who are misusing access to police systems. What I find really interesting is that they're actually being prosecuted, and there's a lot more of misuse of legitimate access to systems that's just not going to the courts. And presumably there's a lot more kind of internal resolution that's being taken with people being fired. So we do see very skewed perceptions depending on where the data is coming from as to what type of actors are involved. We do see with...
So if that's skewed, what is the real picture?
So there's certainly, in terms of kind of volume actors, we're seeing a lot more of kind of cybercrime as a service business models arising. Mirror is a really interesting case in point. When the attacks happened, the offenders actually leaked their source code, or they published their source code on an underground forum, presumably to kind of direct attention away from them and so that anyone could have committed it with this code. And as a result, we then see that code being used to facilitate other denial of service attacks.
Explain what a denial of service attack is.
So denial of service attack is kind of overwhelming resources, typically against an IP address or a website, so other people can't access that website, or the users of that IP address can't access the internet.
It's called DDoS, or a denial
attack
of service.
Yes, certainly.
And it's very common.
It is very common, and this is now available as a service business model. So you can go and use a commit denial of service attacks. Please don't do this at home, with very little technical expertise required. So there's been a change with many different.
Who are the customers here? I mean, are these people, as it were, in search of revenge against an organization or somebody wanting to not do their calculus exam, or somebody seeking gain?
Certainly. I mean, during COVID, there were a lot of attacks against schools because a lot of teaching went online, and therefore people didn't want to have to sit an exam or go to class, and so they would attack their school internet connection. So what we see with the as-a-service business model is that it lowers the barriers to entry. You no longer have to have kind of technical expertise in order to carry out these types of attacks.
So presumably, people using those services are as prone to being phished, scammed, conned out of their money as anybody else, as anybody as an honest actor on the internet.
Perhaps even more so.
They can't go to the police.
Exactly. A lot of offenders are operating in very low trust environments. In order to commit other offences, they need to work with other people, but these are inherently untrustworthy people. And so we have a lot of information asymmetry. You don't necessarily know who to trust and who not to trust. So it can take for some really interesting research.
And indeed, I mean, law organisations have infiltrated this. You write about the FBI took over Dark Market, which was a very successful sort of...
Yeah, that was back in 2008. They were actually operating Dark Market from their offices in Pittsburgh. They were operating the infrastructure.
So Dark Market was one of these services that offered you, you know, kind of software and ways of...
Yeah, so
it was, I mean, criminal activity on the
for carding, yeah. Credit card fraud, that type of activity, yes. And they were operating that, and then we see a very similar operation being done about 10 years later when law enforcement took down Alpha Bay, which was a crypto market, a drugs market, and the Dutch police were actually operating Hansa Market, one of the competitors. So when people left Alpha Bay because it had been taken down, they actually all went and set up accounts then with Hansa Market, which had been operated by police, which was able them to get even more information about the users of these platforms.
Yes. Well, one wonders if any of these dark markets are not being run by law organisations. Jenny Radcliffe, I want to turn to you. You operate almost entirely in what we've been describing as upcode, don't you? Very often with firms that have sophisticated computer systems that they want to protect, but you are operating as a burglar for hire to test their systems at a different level. Just tell us what a burglar for hire does.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of descriptions, really, but it's social engineering is linked to hacking, so that's why it's people hacking, in as much as it works alongside technology a lot of the time. But the point being is it's not a technical hack, it's a psychological hack. It's that upcode that Scott talks about. So it's somebody has to write the script. For a lot of these breaches, someone has to click on the link or open the attachment or in some way give away information that is detrimental to the organisation or themselves. And that's really what social engineering is. The burglar for hire bit is that there's a physical infiltration side to that as well. So obviously gaining access to a device and taking it out with you is very helpful for then our technical partners, if you like, to hack that device. And just to say that obviously we only rob you if you pay us. It's an ethical job.
Of course. I mean, it's not a job that a school careers officer is ever going to suggest. So how did you get into it?
So, well, you know, just to take the first part of that, I think this is actually one of the problems, really, that we're seeing about with this curiosity and boredom thing is that there are careers in security that are every bit as exciting and as varied as what criminal hackers might look to do. It's just that it's not as widely taught at a young level that it should be and not taught necessarily very well. Because if people could realise that there are lots of different careers and lots of different ways in, I mean, Scott, you know, his philosophy, I think, major at one point. There are lots of different ways in, and it speaks to the diversity needed in the security industry to get all these different skills and perspectives because, you know, we need those different skills to combat what we're being hit with. I got into this basically as a kid growing up in Liverpool with not an awful lot to do. You know, the city at the time was part of the sort of decline of the economy and other things. And it was a family thing. It was, let's look at an empty building, let's go and have a look around that, not to break anything or take anything, but just because there wasn't really an awful lot left to do.
I mean, everybody understands that notion that kids are intrigued by empty buildings. You took it up to the next level.
Yeah.
Because you started looking at occupied buildings and...
Well, it was another challenge. And, you know, this is one of the things about motivation. You know, one of the things is if it's there... If it's a big scalp, you know, for criminal hackers, then it's worth taking, partly just as an ego trip. We did it because we were bored, then we wanted more challenges. But eventually, and you know, before too long, I was being paid to do it by the people who owned the buildings because it's sort of a mixture of a
How did they get to find out that you were out there? Again, it's not a job you can easily advertise, is it?
No,
I mean,
it
you
isn't.
Can now.
Right, but it's this domino effect, this sort of cascade that we've spoken about with botnets, really. It's the similar type of thing. It was word of mouth because it was a rare skill, and there wasn't many people who did it, people spread the word. And so initially it was word of mouth. And then obviously once the internet came online and I started to research the job, I realised that particularly in the US, this is a legitimate job. It had a legitimate, it had lots of names, but legitimate names. And that actually a lot of firms are looking to cover all angles of security. One angle that they cannot discount is someone who knows how to work with humans and how to get humans to do what they want them to do, as well as the physical side of things.
You have a very telling line. I don't look at picking a lock. I look at the person whose job it is to keep the lock closed, and then persuade them to open it.
Exactly.
Give us an example. It's a very good example of a firm that had just installed a sort of £2 million security fence and security system, and then they asked you to come along and make sure it worked.
Yeah. I mean, the head of security said to me, said, I know that you're good at getting into places, Jenny. He said, but, you know, we've just spent... The only way you'll get in is if someone leaves the door open for you. No one's ever going to do that. But what we'd looked at was the culture of that firm was very rules driven. It was very hierarchical. If a boss,
when you say there, you had a kind of team at that point, did you?
It's yeah. Not just so you. I work with a couple of associates. It's a small, very niche firm, and we fit the crew to the job. But we knew that that firm was very rules-driven. So therefore, if you were told to do something, you did it. And through a series of capers that we needn't go into now, we managed to get inside the fence, but not into the actual building. And then to get into the building, we wrote...
But just describe the actual method, because I thought the method was very interesting. You knew that... You discovered that they had insurance on the company cars.
Yeah, they had pool cars that were insured, and they did minor site repairs on pool cars. And we'd noticed that in the car parks, this is physical surveillance, old school stuff. We noticed in the car park, there was one car in particular that was right at the back, clearly wasn't used very much. So what we did was we shot out a crack into the windscreen of the car. And then we hired a little van and said that we were there as car repair, on-site car repairs to the security guards. And we had, Tom, the universal key to access to anywhere, which is a high-vis vest and a clipboard. Turned up in a van, looked innocent, very plausible story. We're going to go and check out the vehicle, see if we can do a repair. And we drove in the van, three of us, but only two of us drove out. And I stayed on the site, hid behind some bins. And then we'd printed on a piece of A4, please do not close this door. And we put that to the outside of one of the exterior doors. And because the people in that firm, their upcode was very much, we do what we're told, this is a rule. As soon as sort of four or five people came through the door, and the fifth person wedged the door open. And then obviously we went on site, and we can collect confidential information that should be private. But we film that, we take photographs of that, and then we explain that to the security team. This is what we do. But I think the key point that everyone sort of smiles at is that when I met with the head of security and his number two, he's just looked at his friend, just said, we spent £2 million, and she used a pen and paper, you know? And that sort of speaks to what Scott talks about, which is...
You're using what Scott would call heuristics, aren't you? Which is mental shortcuts, that if there's a sort of route of least resistance, people will generally take it.
And that's one of the problems is that people don't necessarily think that security is their job. They don't necessarily think they're going to be a target, but they also feel that if this doesn't look like a problem, it's not my problem, right? We're all busy and distracted or tired or sick or whatever it is. And we miss things. Humans miss things, which is why the tech needs to do as much heavy lifting as possible to stop these situations occurring to humans all the time, because all of us are vulnerable. The right script, the right situation at the right time is going to catch everyone out. Right? It's just a case of when and how it's done. And so I think what's really interesting when we talk about the tech and in Scott's book is that idea that, you know, that we will still get through the humans. I don't like to say they're the weakest link, because if we say that, we're kind of ignoring the fact that humans can't actually protect themselves.
Scott Shapiro, you write in your book about another very famous hack of Paris Hilton's phone. Which really resulted in, you know, the sharing of kind of personal details and personal photographs. And I think that speaks very directly to what people feel. We all think we've got stuff on our phone that we don't want out in the world. Amazingly, it started with something called a mumble attack. Explain what a mumble attack is.
Yeah, I would say that I had never heard about a mumble attack before before this case. So just in 2005, Paris Hilton's cell phone was hacked and intimate photographs were uploaded onto the web. And the person who had done it, a 16-year-old boy, Cameron LaCroix, he had gotten into hacking. I mean, one of the first things he had done was what you had mentioned, a mumble attack, which is where you call up and you say, I lost my password or I need access to my account. The person in the call center says, okay, you know, what is your password? And you said it's, and they're like, excuse me? And you just mumble it, and you mumble it enough times that the other person on the other line gets so anxious that they just let you through. And I think that's
they supply the digits, right, and ask for confirmation.
Right, exactly. It's because, you know, human beings, we really don't like to say no to people. We really don't like to not be helpful. What was so fascinating about the Paris Hilton hack to me was, you know, in 2005, Paris Hilton probably was the most famous person on the planet. And how in the world did anyone get close enough to her cell phone to get the photographs off of her sidekick too? I mean, she's surrounded by paparazzi and bodyguards. And what nobody had realized at the time is that there was this new thing called the cloud, and that photographs were not just on phones, but they were uploaded and accessible from the web. Cameron was able to get the phone number of Paris Hilton by just calling up a T-Mobile.
He'd seen a picture of her, and he'd seen what phone she was using. Right, knew things about that phone.
It was crazy. It was a commercial where the rapper Snoop Dogg was doing his laundry, and he wanted to know in the commercial when you put in the fabric softener. And they called up Paris Hilton, and Paris Hilton on the commercial says he does his own laundry. That's hot. So he calls up T-Mobile and he says, hi, this is corporate headquarters. We hear that there's a problem with your system. Can you give us your username and password? And the manager just gives it to him and just looks it up. He's like, okay, Paris Hilton does have a phone number with T-Mobile, and then was able to exploit it.
Part of the reason that is happening is because firms are being careless, enormously careless, about building security in at that stage, aren't they?
Yes. So one of the things, I think one of the common assumptions all of us are using is that ultimately this is a people problem. And the reason why it's a people problem, the way I would put it, is because, you know, where do we get computer code from? Where do we get down code from? We don't find it in nature. Human beings write it, and they're responding to incentives, and either money or fame or fun or whatever. And the reason why we have the bad code that we do is because we give people the wrong incentives.
Alice Hutchings.
So I would also like to reiterate that we don't use the term weakest link in the computer security so much anymore, because we're expecting people to behave in ways that is not consistent with their daily lives. We tell people don't click on links, but we send them emails with links in. We say don't open attachments, but in order to do their day-to-day job, they need to open attachments. So we give advice that's not consistent with how we expect them to do their jobs and to go about their daily lives. And this causes these types of problems. But the really, I mean, for me, the really distressing part of this is that people believe that they are the weakest link. They don't go and, you know, report that they've been victimized, or they don't go and, you know, talk to their family and friends about this. And
I mean, they are, of course, sometimes the victims of the architecture of a kind of corporate system that basically wants their money before anything else. But they are also sometimes very careless. I mean, you say Mark Zuckerberg's Twitter password was da, da, da. Kanye West had 6 zeros as the key for his iPhone.
Right, and Barack Obama had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, yeah.
I mean, you can take some steps, can't you?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I mean, what I tell people is, you know, don't open attachments from people you don't know. So you could write back to them and say, I'm sorry, who are you? Now, that's not foolproof, but it is it is a way of just making it a bit harder for people.
Jenny, your book highlights the importance of just pausing and taking a breath and thinking. There's a very interesting attack you do on a German bank, and it's a very high-end bank for high net worth individuals, which you think would have impeccable security because there's a lot of money. Tell us how you got in there.
Yeah, well, impeccable security, but impeccable manners, you see. And so it's absolutely playing on these cultural rules. And, you know, we just knew, I just had an idea that if I was to go in and look pretty vulnerable, I bandaged up my hand and I was carrying some files and then tried to get in using their biotech.
So you were playing a client?
I was playing, sort of loosely in my head. I mean, I was going with it. Tactical adaptation is very important. But, I mean, I was someone who was visiting the site to give a training course in my head. That was the persona. And put my thumbprint on their biotech, on their lock, which, of course, doesn't work because I'm there to infiltrate. I'm not legitimately there. And it says, you know, computer says no, says no, says no. And I was swearing very loudly and creating a big fuss. And in a bank like that, they rely on a very calm, relaxed, luxurious atmosphere. Security guard came over and I sort of shouted and said, you know, this is not working. It wasn't working yesterday. It's about time this was fixed. And it's a horrible idea of, no, you know, we don't want confrontation. And then, you know, my arm was in a bandage. And when he tried to sort of help me, I said it hurt me. And then I dropped all the files. And just to get rid of the fuss, the guy said, oh, for goodness sake, go in. Now, what you have to remember, Tom, is I do look quite innocent as well. And this is because people have these cultural ideas of what a hacker looks like, you know. And I wasn't wearing a black hoodie that day. I always have one within reach, but I didn't have one on that day. And it's a misconception. And I think just to link back to what Alice was saying earlier, we do have to be very careful with the language we use here, because what we don't want to do is tell people the hackers all wear hoodies, or the hackers are all boys, you know, or that hackers are all bad, or that the people can't help themselves. And that's why I think we need awareness is key, education is key, because what we have to do is move away from these cultural stereotypes that are actually quite harmful.
But it's interesting, that thing. You were doing a kind of human DDoS attack, weren't you? You were basically flooding that guard with a whole set of sensations, and he couldn't deal with them all simultaneously and took the short route out.
Yeah, because he assessed the threat didn't look very dangerous, and therefore he's going to let me in, right? And that's the thing. And very importantly, what's important in our aftercare then is to make sure that that person isn't fired, isn't blamed or shamed, even covertly, and that it's used as an education piece to understand that, you know, no matter how this disrupts our normal practices, no matter how awkward the situation might be, we challenge and we amend and we secure ourselves better.
How much easier did your job get when the internet really developed and all of a sudden the world is flooded with information about the targets?
Well, back in the day, you know, we used to have to sit outside premises. We used to have to sit in bars. It was a dirty job, but someone had to do it, to eavesdrop on employees and things. But of course, once the internet came online, it was easier to investigate people. But it's not so much what's on there that we can look for, the companies publish or addresses or whatever else. It's what people want to share. So it's what people put on social media that gives us clues to the big picture that helps as well. So it made the job quicker and deeper very quickly.
Is this part of the real vulnerability, Alice Hutchings, that we willingly share enormous amounts of information? You know, we worry on one side about data hacks and we give it away on the other side.
Certainly. I mean, there's a lot of emphasis put on doxing people, trying to identify where they are based on information they put online. You know, it's been attempts to dox me as well. they came up with some really, really interesting conclusions, which were quite erroneous. But, you know, I put photos of my cat online during the pandemic, so there's some interesting conclusions I made from that.
is that an opening, a picture of your cat? I mean, that will then potentially lead to another link, might lead to a link to somebody who knows you who might reveal a piece of information that you don't want revealed.
Exactly, exactly. I think Jenny put some really nice examples of that in her book as well.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things will be that we now know that Alice likes cats, right? And so the thing is if now you wanted to fish her to send an email with a bad link or even not with a link in, just something to engage the target in conversation. Now we know that maybe an animal lover, maybe we can talk a little bit about that. It's about personalising those approaches that means they're much more targeted and likely to land.
You did a very good phishing attack, didn't you, by sending an all points email to the occupants of a firm saying, we're going to ban coffee in the office from tomorrow.
This was brilliant. We sent it at sort of 4:45 on a Friday or something, and we said, as you've been told before, which they hadn't, and what humans like is to correct mistakes, you are not allowed caffeine on premises from 8 o'clock on Monday morning. If you have caffeine with you, it will be confiscated. And the trick of it was, if you have a problem with this, click on the link or call this number. And of course, everyone had a problem with it and everybody clicked the link. But again, you can do that in a way that is not nasty and is not something that upsets people. Afterwards, people thought that was funny and they still talk about it now. And we still talk about it now. But it uses urgency and sort of basic visceral needs.
We are running out of time very soon. But just very quickly, should we be worried about AI improving the ways in which we can be gamed, Alice Hutchings?
Certainly, we will see more and more of use of things like generative AI, ChatGPT, manipulated photos, but also this is a lot of opportunity there to better detect malicious activity through anomaly detection and looking for patterns of badness and ways in which activity is not consistent with how people really.
And so all of those, it's all going to be much more plausible. Anyway, thank you to all of my guests. Alice Hutchings, Director of the Cambridge Cybercrime Centre, Jenny Radcliffe's People Hacker, and Scott Shapiro's Fancy Bear Goes Fishing are both out now. Many thanks to today's studio engineer, Michael Millam. Next week, Kirsty Walk on the artistry of maths. But for now, thank you and goodbye. Thanks for listening to this edition of Start the Week on BBC Radio 4, produced by Katie Hickman. And if you're after more conversations on art, science, history and politics, you can find many, many more on the BBC Sounds website.